This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to a special series focusing on the role of churches in their neighborhoods. During this series on Place Matters, we will talk to leaders, scholars, practitioners, and mobilizers who speak to the joys and challenges of inviting churches into partnership with their neighborhood. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS, and my colleague, David Park, one of our lead consultants, will be your host for this series of Place Matters. In this special series of Place Matters, we have been exploring the relationship of congregations to their local context. We have made the case that for churches, place should matter too. Any understanding of a thriving congregation is incomplete if it does not include caring well for our neighbors and our neighborhood. We partnered with the Barna Group to put some data behind this. They sent out a survey to church leaders to examine if this connection exists, and if so, to what extent. Sadly, the survey revealed little to no correlation between the traditional metrics of church vitality and how much a church invests in caring for the neighborhood. Place, for these respondents at least, did not seem to matter too much. This isn't the whole story, though. The majority of those who responded to the survey were white leaders. And for this conversation to have any credibility, of course, we must engage a more inclusive and representative audience of leaders. So, we've been talking to our friend, the Reverend Dr. Alvin Sanders, President and CEO of World Impact, about some similar research he and his team have done with Barna to engage black and brown pastors who are serving in lower-income, majority-minority neighborhoods. World Impact is an organization that exists specifically to offer training and equipping for church leaders working in lower-income urban communities. So, what did Alvin and his team discover when they asked about the role of congregations in the neighborhood? Are there signs of hope here? And if so, what can majority culture churches learn to close the church-to-neighborhood gap? Listen in as Dr. Sanders walks my colleague David Park and I through his experience, expertise, and research on how place matters to the urban church.
So the way I thought we could start is just by starting to share a little bit about what your survey was doing, because we've shared a little bit about what our survey's done in, I think, a previous episode. Tell us about the survey.
Yeah. So World Impact partnered with Barna to do a survey on the impact of the urban church, because World Impact's been around since 1971, and we just intrinsically knew, because of the work that we do, that the urban church was a very critical piece of the landscape. And so we knew that sort of intrinsically, and we wanted to get that proven in a academic, so to speak, way. And so that's why we worked with them, authorized the survey, and because we really felt like the urban church are sort of crowns of beauty within the neighborhood that doesn't get its just due. It doesn't get the voice that it should have within larger Christendom.
That is the most commonest just restrained Alvin I've ever heard describe anything. So, okay, help us define what do you mean by the urban church? Who are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about, if you're talking about urban church, basically, okay, I'll give you the sociological definition of urban, and I'll give you the evangelical definition of urban. So the sociological definition of urban is the three D's. It's density. The amount of people that's within a specific geographic space. And then the other one is diversity, which means that within that density of people, you're going to have all types of ethnicities, races, social class, sexuality, so forth and so on. And the third thing is distance, meaning that how we define time and space. So for instance, I live in Cincinnati. If you say, how far is it from point A to point B? I'm going to say it's 20 minutes. you live in Atlanta like you do, David, how is it from point A and point B? You're going to say with traffic, right? You're going to quantify that, right? So the 3Ds is this, all of that, and all of those things intertwine and mix, which create what's called a worldview of how you see the life and how you see the world. So that's the sociological definition. The evangelical Christian definition for urban is black, brown, poor. It's codified word for black, brown, and poor, which is, you know, it's not a, it's just, it is what it is, right? So we define urban utilizing both of those definitions, a sociological definition, and then for practical purpose, you also have to talk within, for lack of a better term, the Christianese definition.
And why are you focused on the urban church? What compels you to start there?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the focus of world impact. Our problem they're trying to solve is that 95% of the world's pastors have no formal ministry training. And so we bring effective, affordable, and accessible ministry training to those pastors. They're severely underserved, And so we want to make sure that they have what they need in order to be effective in their neighborhoods and their communities. So that's why we focus on the urban church.
All right. So what were some of the initial results or some of the highlights of this survey?
So I would just say the biggest nugget of information from the survey was that both the unchurched and the church within the urban setting wanted the same thing. And that was they wanted a place to belong. So even if the unchurched did not, well, obviously, because we called them the unchurched, they don't go to a church. If what they look for the church to give them is a place to belong, they want to combat the malady of loneliness, and they want community. They want moral guidance when things like George Floyd happens. Even though they may not go to the church, they still see the church as a moral agent within the community, and they're looked up to, as well as the pastors and the ministers are looked up to as there, which is sort of diametrically opposed to what's going on typically within the white evangelical church right now. So that's probably the biggest finding, that even though, you know, I'm a child of John Perkins and the Christian Community Development Association, even though it is good to do the works of food pantries and housing and all those types of things, our research shows, surprisingly, that the number one thing that the neighborhood wants from the church is relationship, is community, and is moral guidance. Or in other words, they want the church to be the church. So, and that's
Alvin. I don't know what he's talking about. What he's talking about, David.
That's a tall order, sir.
Well, you know, one of the things I've started doing this year is because I got convicted. I ran across this reading of Gandhi, and Gandhi, even though he wasn't Christian, read the Sermon on the Mount every day. Wow. And I said, you know what, as a minister of the gospel, I should do that. And I'm not as disciplined as him. I don't read it every day, but I started since the beginning of the year reading it more than more days of the week I read it than I don't. How's that? So I'm going to read it at least four times out of a 7-day week. And I am just struck by how radical it's asking us to be.
Wow.
I mean, if you haven't read it lately, go back and read Matthew 5-7. You're going to be like, oh my goodness. It is just so powerful and grips you like this is the real Christian life, right? So it is an uphill battle, as we see in Paul's letters, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, to live that out. And in fact, there is really only one church. I may be wrong, but if I remember my New Testament correctly, there is really only one church that is not admonished for doing something wrong. That is the small church in Philadelphia in the book of Revelation, where Jesus says nothing but good things to say about them. But every other church, there's good things to say and there's bad things to say. And I am a proponent of the church. I am not somebody who, I actually think right now, the church, people are going overboard. They're going crazy. Like, we have some other option. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are evangelical tracts. And in the book of Acts says, Jesus says, I'm going to change the world through the establishment of the local church. So people who are just saying, oh, well, I'm just going to leave the church, or we don't need the church, they're not being biblical. So we don't have anything other than the church. So our job is to be salt and light as best we possibly can, and to establish healthy churches as best as we possibly can. Because that's what the world needs. We truly believe at World Impact, the local church is the hope of the world. So I'm not shocked by scandals and this, that, the other. I mean, human beings make up the institution. That's what's going to happen, right? I think people suffer from idealism, and they think that there's not supposed to be any issues or problems with the church. So as long as people are authentically trying to follow Christ, and then you deal with the issues that are going on. Of course, I'm not here for any of the shenanigans that are going on, like Christian nationalism and all that stuff. But that is not, in my opinion, that is not the average person experience. Or maybe I just had an above average experience my whole life. I mean, I don't know. I'm 54. You know, every church that
you're 6'8", man.
No, I mean, there was problems, but there was good stuff too, and the good stuff outweighed the problems. Every church I've ever been a part of, I probably throughout my life have been part of, I don't know, maybe 6-7 churches, including the one that I started. So I don't know. It just seems like people, I mean, I'm getting ready to sound like old man, get off my lawn guy, but it's like folk are just soft. They just fall apart when there's a problem in the church. It's like, what did you think? It's human beings. Of course, somebody might run off with the secretary or whatever, right? But if the people are trying to be authentic and follow the Lord, that's what you're looking for. Now, if that's not there, okay, I understand that. But the majority of the pastors that I know, they're trying to make a dollar at 15 cent. They're rising up. They're doing the best they can to lead that church. They're not going to be perfect. And, you know, it's under 200 folk. And maybe that's the problem, because mega churches and scandals take up so much of the bandwidth that we forget that the landscape is not that.
Yeah. Well, but I think you may be speaking from the perspective of urban churches, in that I agree with you. I think most urban churches are worth their salt and are, like you said, they are seen as a moral authority because they haven't sabotaged or subverted what is the sort of the substance of the gospel. Whereas I think a lot of people who aren't going to urban churches may have a different experience. I think our survey sort of, our data says, kind of correlates with that, I think, as we're seeing that churches thrive apart from their neighborhoods, and their sense of success has nothing or little to do with their neighborhoods, where your survey has a different population saying otherwise.
Yeah, that's a that's a theological disconnect. Absolutely.
I'm interested in this, like, this finding of this desire for a place to belong. So there's an author, a researcher that writes about neighborhoods, who is not a Christian, and has an entire, like, set of messages, articles, chapter in his book where he's just really focused on, like, the church can be the, he does use the word redemption, but he's using this language of the church could be this powerfully redeeming force. And I'm reading, I'm like, wait a second. I've been a pastor. I've got all the theological degrees, and I'm like, I feel like he's being more hopeful about the church than I am right now. So I was a little bit, I felt kind of bad about myself. Where I was like this, because he's looking at it from a sense of like, if you just look at a neighborhood, just strictly from like, what's going to make it healthy and what are the institutions that are there that are going to make this place healthy? And he's like very loud about saying the churches should be playing this role. And to your point about this should be, I mean, where else do you have multi-generational belonging? Where else do you have annual rhythms and rituals of life and practice? And like, where else is this, should this be happening? But again, when you've to the, you know, primarily white-led churches that showed up in the survey, like they're so distant from any sense of like belonging for them are only the people who drive a half hour to be inside the sanctuary at the same time versus like, no, we're trying to cultivate belonging at a street level with the people right around us. And I think to me, that's, if there's any sense of moral authority, it's not because of moral perfectionism, it's because of relationship and trust, right? Like if a stranger does something wrong, I probably doubt their character. But if my good friend does, I'm like, he just had a bad day, right? And so I think the moral authority of the church sometimes is just like, are you known and trusted? And when you make mistakes, do you own them? Or do you like what? It can be a lot just more human and simple, I think, at that very close local level.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's been educated at two evangelical institutions, you know, what was the guy who wrote the guy from World Vision, Rich Stearns, A Hole in the Gospel, you know, community engagement was not a pillar of typical evangelical theology. And so that doesn't that doesn't surprise me if you're talking to a bunch of white evangelicals and they don't see community engagement as a pillar, because that it just hasn't. Mm-hmm. Whereas from African-American context, social justice has been a main pillar of theology. There was never a great divorce. I mean, if you research where white evangelicalism came from, it was because the social gospel rose up in the early 20th century because of the fact that there were some churches that were leaving the tenets of the truth and the theological moorings, and they were saying we need to be socially emphasized. And then this group rose up and they wrote the five fundamentals, and then the fundamentalism eventually evolved into evangelicalism with Billy Graham and that crew. And they did a disservice because they left this huge hole of justice. They went too far the other way. So there's this hole that's really never been fulfilled. And I hope that with the reckoning that's been coming with white evangelicalism, the evangelicalism that will emerge, because there will be something that emerges, hopefully it has community engagement in their theology.
Becca, would you say that as do you find yourself being sort of disillusioned as well with sort of the churches that you've been a part of? And I mean, because I think it's really interesting that Sean is saying he's disillusioned and disenchanted with white leadership. But I think it's interesting just to contrast that with Alvin's hope for the church, right? He's like, I don't see what you guys have clearly missed the boat already. So, but I don't know. What have your observations and lived experience been?
Yeah, I think I've had a very unique church experience. As I feel like I've attended a range of churches, but would say they've all reflected pretty overwhelmingly like white evangelical leadership from the beginning of my experience at church, and then have kind of evolved the longer I have, you know, been going to church and living in the world, with the exception of my current church context, which I'll get to. But yeah, I mean, I think I grew up and it was all that I knew. I went to this large church and there was some level of diversity, and then by the nature of like, it was so big and my town was not that big. And so it was drawing people from a couple different corners, of the city. But like the leadership itself and like the, I guess, flavor of the teachings was not diverse by any means. It was a large evangelical church, typical, like as you drove out of the parking lot, there was a sign that said, "You are now entering the mission field." And I don't have time to unpack that. So from there, I think my disillusionment kind of like swung me from like kind of, I was in a pretty legalistic tradition. And so I was like, I want anything but that, and swung to a non-denominational church that was actually a satellite of a very large, very prominent evangelical church based in Atlanta. And found myself, you know, being excited about like the energy, and it felt like, oh, like there were so many rules here, and there don't really feel like there's any rules here, until you stay a little bit longer and you're like, oh, there's rules everywhere. They look a little bit different. And then I finally found myself like settling back in like the Anglican tradition. So really moving away from a traditionally evangelical tradition into somewhat, I mean, Anglicans would argue with you if they're evangelical or mainline. It just depends on who you are. Now I go to a really small rural church. All that to say, I think I find myself identifying as this like forever churchgoer person, right? And that I get a lot of my identity and a lot of my upbringing is rooted in this, like, I go to church and I find community in church and I find places to serve or opportunities through the church. But then I also find myself being angry at the church and feeling like an outcast in my own church and feeling like I'm sitting in a pew and being like, I'm happy to be here because I feel like I want to be here, but I'm also mad because you're not saying what I want you to say, or you're straight up saying the opposite of what I'm hoping to hear. And so it's this weird tension of like, I personally find so much meaning and have so much hope, like Alvin was saying, in what the church could be, that I want to stick around because I just don't think that it's finished yet. But I also find so much frustration in kind of where we've gone and the way that culture and politics have like just made a mess of everything. And so I find myself holding these things of being like, I love this thing, but this thing also just makes me want to like air punch sometimes. And so I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I answered your question fully, but that's just the tension that I find myself. I think it's what keeps me in the work is this desire to remain in the tension, because I feel like I'm in the in between is maybe where things start to get figured out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I think sometimes where I'm find the struggle is, you know, Alvin, just some examples about like, what do we expect? This is like, if you've got one human in the room, that institution is going to go poorly, right? Like this, and you're probably, if you have a church of one, you'll probably split at some point even then. Like this is just a nature of like human beings, right? So I'm like, yes to all of that. And like what I tend to like, I'm to continue to wrestle through is like, it's one thing to say like the Matthew 5-7, we're about the way of Jesus. And as we get it wrong, we're going to be super honest about that and continue to fall forward to something more. Right. Versus where I feel like so much of what we're dealing with is like, you're not even trying like in any ways that you aren't in alignment with the way of Jesus, you convince yourself that it's fine, or you explain it away, or like a scandal is one thing, but like protecting the ego of the power leader and covering up the scandal, something else versus like, no, there's a scandal in our leadership and we're dealing with it honestly and openly. And I think that's where, whether you're an insider churchgoer or outsider, you know, I think that's where we get frustrated of like, are we even trying to be about the thing we're trying to be about? So I had the opportunity. This is the beauty of being in Atlanta. In seminary to study preaching with Dr. Joseph Roberts, who followed King Sr. at Ebenezer, and was obviously an incredible opportunity to study preaching with this guy. And he took us all, like, set up a one-on-one lunch with everybody that was in his class. And I can't wait. I've got so many questions, you know. And so, like, in the course, most of my questions, I'm reflecting on it now. I'm like, yeah, that was dumb. And most of the questions are like, I'm driven to be the kind of preacher that would speak into the way of Jesus as it intersects with the realities of our world, right? And in my context, you're going to do that, and like that's going to be a hard road to walk, right? You're probably not going to be, people aren't going to be that excited about what you got to say, right? And so I'm like trying to talk to him about like, you know, the conflict, the pushback, the challenges, whatever. And what was so funny is like he's just eating a salad and he kind of just shrugs. He's like, yeah, my church expected me to preach about that kind of stuff. But I was like, oh, you're not going to be any help, are you? to what it means to have to say this in places where we're like, no, that ain't what Jesus is about. We're going to be about something else. So that's where I'm like hopeful at some level, but also struggling to say like, if we could, like, I'm fine with struggle and mess up and big, even big mess ups. If we can just say like, no, we're going to be about the way of Jesus. And when we're not, we'll be honest about that and find ways to be better about it. But it just seems like, again, the contrast of your survey versus ours, which was responded to by predominantly white audience, is like there are fundamentally different theologies operating in our context of what it means to be the church in our world. And that's a problem that we've got to enter into.
So is your audience an urban audience, or was it a suburban audience, or was it a mixture?
That's one of the things we're going to be delving into further with the results of this survey. I think we were so troubled by it. We're now asking, okay, when you say you're from this place, exactly what do you mean? Mm-hmm. Is that place urban? Is it rural? Is it suburban? Is it exurban? Whatever,
yes.
Whatever the case may be. I think we're going to have to delve into the data a little more. I think just the initial demographic of it being overwhelmingly white means that we're going to have to be a lot more critical of sort of where people are responding from and understanding their context as well. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, Alvin, was it seems like the demographics in America seem to be shifting so that people become more entrenched in these preferences and biases even the sort of aware, like, worldview of neighborhood seems to be like, if you're not in it now, it's going to be really hard because it's going to take a stretch to sort of your own worldview and may require a relocation. Is the urban church, from your experience, is it shifting at all, or is that sort of the last? I mean, we've heard, you know, in Atlanta, we're experiencing, you know, gentrification and things shifting from suburban back into re-urban. So is that happening for you, and how does that affect your work with urban churches?
Well, again, if you go back to the definition of urban, diversity is built into the definition. So when you go to a when you go to an urban space, it is automatically assumed, and rightly so, that differing opinions are going to be expected. Right. So, and to varying degrees, there will be polarization within that diversity, but I've yet to hear or read or know from a personal experience anybody who says, I'm moving to the city because I want to be more isolated. That's why they're coming to the city, right? They don't want to be isolated. They were in an isolated place. They were in a place where everybody thought the same, or everybody did everything the same, or just at the other. And they're like, man, I'm not with this. I'm going to the city because I'm going to find my pocket of people, right? Where I can interact with, or I respect a diversity of views. So that's why I want to be in the city. So that's like this, one of the main definitions of what it means to be urban, is that you want to be in a space where there's differing ideologies and different views.
Do you find that people that were traditionally more urban becoming suburban, and how does that affect, does that affect things?
What do you, I need to know more context. What do you mean by they're becoming more suburban? Are you talking about worldview?
Well, so no. Well, I totally agree with you. I think you're right. When people do move to the city, I mean, the statistics show that you're absolutely right. They are looking for more diversity. They're usually younger. They're more tech savvy. Mm-hmm. They're more open to different ideas and different ways of being. I guess, but conversely then, are you seeing that the old guard or the urban folk are moving outwards? And how does it affect you if the demographics for you start to shift more young, white, progressive, liberal, whatever the case may be, than it had been before.
Yeah, people who want, you know, I can't prove this, but this is just my life experience. People, it's like, for instance, this neighborhood that I live in, west side of Cincinnati, it was brand new. Let's see, it was 2024. We built our house 2006-ish, so it's about 20 some odd years old, right? And the people who are on my street, when I met them, I could tell who was going to be out of here once they got kids. Because there's a life change that happens. And a lot of the times it's the having of the kids that they go, okay, I don't like all this diversity. I don't like all this stuff. Let me go hightail it to the suburbs or to a rural space where people are going to be more like me. And I'm not necessarily, and this isn't codified white people. This is black folk too, with certain monies and social classes and mindset, you know. I'm going to hightail it out to be close to where more my tax bracket is or whatever it may be, because I want less diversity. I want less diverse thought in my life. So folk who when they reach that mindset and that worldview, yes, they do. I think they leave diverse settings and they go to the burbs and rural spaces.
Hey guys, just jumping in real quick to say that we would love to take your church and local partners through our 2-year cohort process called City Shapers. The cohorts that are launching this year will be funded partially by Lilly Endowment, so it's a great time to get involved. We have had 3 communities go through this process so far and would love to bring it to you next. So contact us today to learn more at fcsministries.org.
Do you find that if there's an influx of younger, more progressive, or more educated, I guess, folks come in to urban spaces, does that affect urban churches as well?
Yeah.
Or now, just urban neighborhoods?
Now remember, if we take the sociological definition of urban, those people already exist within urban spaces. Now, if we're talking about Christendom, well, you're talking about younger white folk moving into gentrified spaces, right? Mm. Because this, because millennials and younger generations, they didn't want to be in a suburban space. They wanted to be in cool, hip, urban spaces. So if you're talking, if we're talking about the Christian mindset, they're not coming. I call it, and I don't use this pejoratively, it's like the Tim Keller type model. You know, it's those folk want a different type of church than like the churches that World Impact works with. So it affects like the church that I planted and started, like River of Life Church, when I planted it and started it in 2000, pastor 2007, is a totally different place than what it is now. Even though I don't pastor it, I still go there because the neighborhood that it's in has been totally completely gentrified. And since we've always tried to draw the neighborhood, the social class group that was coming to the church has totally completely changed. It's mainly white collar now. We still have some blue collar elements, but it's a white collar church now. So that's how my church has changed.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the city of Atlanta in the last 15 years has had certainly an explosion of a particular demographic that really wants the urban lifestyle and urban experience, and multi-ethnic as well. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just the stereotype of the young millennial kind of moving in looking for breweries, coffee shops, and a cool urban church, right? And, those people exist and they're there, but a number of these, kind of the new version of urban church led by younger folks, more multi-ethnic leadership. Yep. In many ways it's like, this still just looks like the suburban model. But if the suburban model recruited to your like consumer sensibilities with like youth programs or whatever it was that suburban churches were offering, better worship services, like we've kind of just found a new consumer appeal. And but we're doing it in the city now, and like some of the consumer appeal is we're going to be a church that's for the city, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to be the light in the city. We're going to redeem the city. We're going to renovate the city. We're going to change the city. So this becomes now the new consumer pull, but it's like it's still the same people doing the same activities inside that building and largely disconnected from the churches that are already there. I remember going to a conference one time. They're like, "Hey, since this conference is in this like historic black neighborhood, we wanted to have a pastor from the neighborhood to come in." And he came, and I'm like, "He's only been here like this is not a historic black pastor from a historic black neighborhood. This is a guy that's brought in one of the new urban models for that like white collar, educated, diverse, multi ethnic crowd. Where it's like this is not a historic urban church that's been in this neighborhood for a couple of generations. This is a different thing that you're kind of putting out there." And so it's like, I think even though we're seeing a growth of more younger, more multi-ethnic urban churches, it's still at some level kind of feels like not a lot off of what we were seeing that white flight gave us with the suburban church. But again, that may be my own unfair evaluation that's unscientifically proven, but no. As an observation, I don't know, Becca, David, or Alvin, if you guys have seen that similar. I would say
a lot of those types that you've talked about, because I've talked to them as they've come into the community where I used to pastor. They want to be multi-ethnic, but they have extreme trouble doing multi-ethnic. When you really talk to them about, okay, well, if you really want to do this, you're going to have to do X, Y, Z. You know, you got to do all this stuff. And then they kind of drop the ball on that. But I will say, though, they at least have the consciousness that their suburban counterparts didn't even have. They at least know they're supposed to do something. Bar is kind of low, right? But at least they know I'm supposed to do something. And some of them do wade in. But I'm talking to a younger guy now. I'm sort of mentoring him, and he's in Southern California, and he is authentically trying to change the mindset of his church, which is in a neighborhood that has gone the opposite way of gentrification. It was up to you know, it was a well-to-do neighborhood, but now it, the demographics have changed. And he's saying, we're going to stay right here and we're going to reach the people who are here now. And he's dragging his people with them. Now, that type of courage is rare, but it is there, mm-hmm. and it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Alvin, can you tell us, like you mentioned that urban churches have had social justice as part of their distinctive and held on to that as almost a necessary, you know, defense and survival mechanism. What are some other distinctives of urban churches that really distinguish them from, you know, non-urban suburban churches?
I would
say theologically or
problematically. Well, the theological ethic of community engagement is probably the biggest one. That our responsibility is to make this neighborhood a better place, or to seek out the common good of the community. That's probably the biggest deal. The other one is, being creative with the, being open to partnering with other entities and not necessarily being isolated, not being super isolated with other things, with which it's easier to be isolated. I guess that's the way I want to say it. In a suburban context, you really can just be about your own business and don't worry about anything else and you'll be fine. It's very hard to do that in an urban context because there's always dynamics that are happening that it's going to affect you, whether you can try to be within your four walls, but you know, if a soccer club builds a stadium down the street from your church, you're going to be affected. And you better start talking to some people to figure out, you know, what the heck's going on. If it ain't nothing, but all of a sudden you try to drive in on a Sunday morning and your parking lot's full because the soccer team has a game the same day. So if it's that little, you know, you just can't put the walls up and say, circle the wagons, because there's just too much going on. It kind of, you're going to have to engage. So.
I see. That's interesting.
Yeah.
What are some practical things that urban churches do with regards to engagement? Like when you say they have to engage the neighborhood and sort of seek the common good of the neighborhood, like what are some like bare minimum common practices of urban churches in engaging the community?
Well, within our research, the number one, let me ask Sean and Becca, what do you think the number one way an urban church engages its community? What do you think it is?
Oh.
Don't be too deep on it.
Yeah. I don't know. Food
ding,
based
ding,
engagement.
Ding, ding. Yeah. The food pantry is the number one thing.
Yeah.
Everybody has a food pantry. But I mean, there's a variety of things, from tutoring to, you know, some who go the super duper CCD route of trying to do housing, that's at the other. But the number one thing that pretty much everybody does, the most common way of neighborhood engagement, is food pantry. Now, if you compare it to their non-urban counterparts, the thing that they offer more than their non-urban counterparts, which I find very interesting, is counseling. So there's a recognition that you need mental health within this space that doesn't seem to be present within the suburban context.
One of the things our survey found was not only is there very little relationship between the church and the neighborhood, sometimes it's like a negative relationship. Like, it seemed to be that like as they were getting, and I might be misquoting this, Becca, so correct me if I'm wrong. It seemed like after a certain amount of budget was spent, like mid-sized churches did better in terms of spending money on local missions than smaller churches, and larger churches might spend more dollar wise, but it was a smaller proportion of their budget.
Yeah.
Is there any, did you do any like financial spending, or how did urban churches spend their money differently when it came to like local mission, local neighborhood stuff?
No, we didn't do any look at budget.
Mm-hmm. I see. I guess, is there a minimum size or an ideal size or a threshold by which churches, once they reach a certain size, they're able to sort of have more impact or be a little bit more or outward focused? Because it seemed like churches in non-urban spaces seem to be like, you have to get up past a certain size before they can lift their head up and see the neighborhood even.
Yeah. It really just depends on the mentality of the church and what they deem important. So like, you know, there are church planting organizations that'll say, well, you can't start a church unless you have at least $250,000 raised. And then you look, okay, why do you need $250,000? And then when you look at it, it's like 90 to 95% all based on internal stuff. You need staffing, you need, you know, the LCD wall, you need, you know, all this stuff that's 100% about the performance and not about engaging the community whatsoever. And that's part of a reason why folk are thumbing their nose at the church, because they're like, why would you spend that much money? What was that campaign that came out? They did a commercial during the Super Bowl. He knows us or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a prime example just within my house, you know, because I got two 20-year-olds, right? And they were thoroughly unimpressed. And I'm like, well, why are you unimpressed with these commercials? They're like, well, why didn't they take that money and actually start putting it towards the things they're talking about Jesus did?
Yeah.
Right. So to me, that's like that's the church planting deal of it. You don't need $250,000 to start a church. Really, all you you know, if you know, as a former church planter, all you need is basically, can you raise enough money that your family can have a decent salary, health insurance, and that's kind of it. You don't really need. I mean, maybe a little money for a little bit of ministry and budget. Maybe rent a space.
Do any dry ice at all? No lasers?
No. It's just, you don't need it. You know, we broke down at World Impact what we thought it would take. If you're bivocational, like $15,000.
Wow.
A year? Yeah. I mean, to start. Like if your bivocation, your biggest expense is you. You don't have any people, right? So, if you just say, you know what, I'm gonna take care of me by I'm gonna go work. Okay, well then, what else do you really have?
Yeah.
Maybe rent a space. You know, I mean, if you break down the service to its basics, you need somebody who can sing. You need somebody who can preach. You need a cup of coffee and some cookies. I mean, if we're talking bare minimum, I'm not talking about you're birthing a full-fledged church. I'm talking about what do you bare minimum need to have a gathering of people. Think about that.
You need Holy Spirit.
You need
that's about it.
You need a space. You need some people. A couple of refreshments. You're good to go.
Well, and it's funny too, because like we're laughing about it, but I'm thinking back to like what you said about belonging at the beginning, and like I don't know. I went to this small church in college that just didn't have a lot going on. There wasn't a lot of bells and whistles, and I would say I felt like I belonged at that church more than when I went to the mega church satellite plant that had a lot of bells and whistles. I'm talking T-shirts and kickoffs and fog machines and all that stuff. Yeah. And I mean, don't even get me started on my Church of Origin Christmas festival parade that we used to. I mean, that was crazy. Talk about extra expenses. But like,
they had an actual camel, didn't they?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Live animals in our church sanctuary, people flying in the sky. Oh, it was a whole thing. But
bless their heart.
The way I just, the belonging that I did not feel there compared to the belonging that I felt in these much smaller, much simpler spaces. I mean, I think we try to buy belonging, and I just don't think that it works.
Well, I think I'm hopeful for the future, because I think there's a necessary corrective space that we're in right now.
Yeah.
I don't mind the deconstruction, what bothers me is people don't reconstruct.
Right.
They just deconstruct. And it's like, okay, great. We all know the problems. What are you going to do about it? How can we, how can we build something more authentic for the next generation? Right.
Yeah.
And I know I've done it. I mean, our church is 24 years old. It's a small family church. Nobody goes to River of Life for the bells and whistles. There's very little to consume there. That, to me, that's like my, my crowning achievement, that I've created a church that there's very little to consume. You know, there really isn't.
That's a shocker.
Yeah.
I forgot to tell you guys that Alvin is blisteringly pragmatic.
Yes. It's
it sounds like his kids have picked up on that too.
Yeah. I mean, there's very little to consume, but people love that church. You know, you come in, there's this big, the carpet is old in the sanctuary. You know, there's a big, big, what do you call it? Spot from 20 years of Kool-Aid spills or whatever. You know, it's just, it's not a dump. Don't get me wrong. It's not a dump, but it's not like, you know, there's, you can see it's flawed. That's what I'm saying. You see all our flaws. Right. It's if you're coming there for a high, professional production, you're going to be deeply disappointed. But if you're coming there for a decent worship experience and the Bible is taught, and the biggest tell about our church is there's going to be people in the lobby 90 minutes to 2 hours after church is over still talking. Hanging out.
I mean, with that belonging as the core thing, it was interesting, you know, when the pandemic hits and we can't gather as we have before, like the thing that was so stressful that everybody ran to is like, all right, here's the proof of when you strip church down to what you think matters more than anything else, what do you do? And it was all about getting your service online, right? And I'm like, Isn't belonging that, like, if you stripped it all down, isn't the belonging part the most important thing? Like, I mean, like, I can turn on the internet and listen to worship music at any time of the day, any day of the week, anywhere. I can listen to way better preaching on podcasts any day of the week, anywhere else. And so, like, the fact that, like, our instinct was like, oh no, we got to make sure that people still have the service thing captured online versus like, instead of saying, oh no, people are gonna be isolated and alone and separate. And like, yes, we got to keep people safe. We got to protect our health. But if we've got to innovate and bear the stress of pivoting, it's got to be around how people stay connected and loved. And, but and I saw some of that, but the majority that I saw that was like the stressful move to pivot was just towards how do we now get our service online? I mean, I'm not opposed to online services, fine, do them, whatever, but it was a tell that no matter what we say about our theology and community and churches about belonging and community and family and all this kind of stuff, well, when we're forced to strip it down to the absolute bare minimum of what it means to be this congregation together, for a lot of people, it wasn't belonging that was the core nugget. It was a, it was still the consumption of a service, right?
Now, the interesting thing that's, I mean, that's starting to come out a little bit, and somebody actually, well, somebody probably is doing a deep research on this church after the pandemic, there are indications that a lot of mega churches didn't bounce back.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I know there's mega churches around here. They've had to cut the number of services that they had. They've had to close campuses. Where interestingly enough, the smaller family churches actually got more value and actually are growing a bit. I'm sure somebody's got to be researching that out, but I think it speaks to what you were saying, Sean, about, I think people said, man, I, you know what, at the end of the day, I want community. I'll take a little less service. I'll take a little less smoke and mirrors and all that. I just want some people to know who I am. I want people to know my name. I want people to know who my kids are. You know, I want to know the pastor's name. I want to see them in the restaurant. And they actually know I go to their church, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
Well, Alvin, to sort of close, I think a lot of churches who are in that pivot stage or who are recognizing, hey, we do need to be more invested in place. I mean, that's that's been our clarion call. That's the drum we've been beating for a while. Could you like sum it up for us? Say it again so that people can hear you. What are some lessons of the urban church that people who are leading non-urban churches or maybe are like learning about this, what are some of the things that they really need to take home with them?
It needs to, I'll tell you the one thing, because I'm a minimalist, just focus on one thing. It needs to become a communal space. What does it mean? They need to wrestle with, here's where we're planted. What does it mean for us to be a communal space, not only for our people, which it seems like what your survey is saying, they're focused on making it a communal space for their people. Well, how do we make this a communal space for our neighborhood at the same time? Right. So, you know, there was a book written years and years ago that Starbucks took it and made it their business model called the third space. Right. What's the third space? It's not home. It's not work. Right. How many times have you had a meeting with a friend at Starbucks? Right. You go, oh, meet me at Starbucks. Right. Or something, Panora, you know, something like that, where, yeah, you're going to get some food. Yeah, you're going to get some coffee or whatever. It's at the other. But you're drawn to that space because it's a place where you can be communal, where you can have a Bible study or you can talk to somebody or you can meet an old friend. I mean, when I hit Atlanta a couple of years ago, David, that's exactly what we did. Me, you, and Ruth. Right. We went to Barnes and Noble.
Mary Max.
Yeah. Or what was it? Wherever it was. Oh, yeah. We just met. No, not the Mary Max. The
I didn't go that time.
Yeah, we didn't go there. We were on a mission. That wasn't communal. That was a mission. Right. But we met at the bookstore and we kicked it for like two, three hours and we just caught up. So what does that look like for the local church? Right? Yeah. And start to have an imagination around how can we make this a communal space where our church people can collide with the community people, because the community, at least if you're in an urban space, the community is looking for a reason to come into your church. And they're probably not coming for a worship service, but that's okay. What will they come in for? And then whatever they'll come in for, some of them will trickle into exploration of spirituality. And when Christmas and Mother's Day and Easter hits, they go, oh yeah, what was that church we played soccer at? You know, our kids played soccer at. Well, let's go check that church out. You know, that's how that stuff works. So it's all about creating a communal space for the community.
Yeah.
Well, it is.
Wow. Mm. Thanks, Alvin. Thanks for your research and thanks for the work that you do with our World Impact and equipping urban church leaders. We're fans and we're glad that we got to compare and contrast our data results.
Yeah.
Appreciate you, Alvin.
Yeah, thank you, Alvin. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right.
One of the best ways that we can offer to see what it looks like to partner well with the neighborhood is for you to come here for a visit. We love hosting guests in historic South Atlanta. In the spring and the fall, we host a two-day immersive event called Open House. So please come, meet our team, see the work, walk our neighborhood. To register for this, go to fcsministries.org/openhouse. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you'd like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you'd like to watch these episodes, the video can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like these episodes, please share them on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.